We're live. Good evening. Tonight's topic, musical instruments on Shabbat. Introduction. So contrary to some people here think, you're not going to get an answer tonight. Yes.
Good night.
This is what we're going to do. We're going to go through the sources, then see the arguments presented in the Talmud, and then we'll see sources, mostly the codes, medieval codes, for and against, and we'll summarize what the arguments are. So my shout-out tonight goes to two primary sources. One is Ethan Tucker of Machon Hadar. You can find his paper online. And the other was I dug up the original responsa from the conservative movement by a Rabbi Philip Siegel in 1958, and the question was playing an organ. And in 1970, the conservative movement came out with another one, which I couldn't find, which expanded on the organ. So as always, you be the judge. So the first part of this is going to be sources from the Tanakh. And the question is, just in general, biblically speaking, is music okay? Is music okay in the temple? Is music okay on Shabbat? What kind of music is okay? And I'm going to go through this fast, and I'm not going to do everything because there's a lot of sources here you can study on your own. So first we have Exodus chapter 15, verses 20 and 21. Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and dances, and Miriam sang to them. A timbrel is a tambourine. I had fun looking these things up. So the point of this is to show you that music is used to praise God, and that exists early in the Torah.
But this has nothing to do with Shabbat.
We'll get there. We'll get there. I want to point out also that there are two types of music, actually. There's instrumental music, and there's vocal music, as you see in this verse. And they're actually should be treated separately. They're two different things. Vocal music is a lot less problematic than instrumental music. But we continue. Next quote from Numbers. Also on the day of your gladness, on your Yom Tov, your new moons, you shall blow with trumpets, etc. Okay, the purpose of this verse is to show you that music, explicitly horns, were used in the temple service, at least on Yom Tov. Question that scholars debate is, does this apply to Shabbat as well? Continuing, 2 Samuel, and David and all the house of the Lord, house of Israel, played before the Lord with all manners of instruments made of cypress wood, harps, psalteries, timbrels, sistra, and with cymbals. So the point of this is to show you that music was played in the temple in the time of David, which is around 1000 BCE. So now we have, coming up from the age of Miriam, we're about 300 years later.
Good question.
Yeah.
How could David have been in the temple?
Good question. It doesn't say temple,
doesn't
you're
say
right.
Yeah.
So it says playing before the Lord.
Playing before the ark.
So, yeah, you're right. So it was before the ark.
Okay,
then we come to Nehemiah. These were the days of so-and-so, and here's the important thing, the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem. They sought the Levites out to bring to Jerusalem singing and cymbals, psalteries, and harps. So from here, we get some kind of a dedication ceremony with temple, and there is singing, and it sounds like this is very ancient because Levites are doing it, meaning there's a lot of precedent for it. Now we get to Psalms. Is that my last quote? No, yeah, oh. Okay. Give thanks to the Lord with harp, sing praises in psaltery, sing unto him. So once again, there is singing and there is instruments. Psalms 92. A psalm, a song for the Sabbath day. Here's the answer. We know it's on Shabbat for the first time. It's good to give thanks to the Lord, to sing praises unto him, blah, 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 with an instrument of 10 strings and with psaltery and with a solemn sound upon the harp. So this is our Shabbat citation. And finally, the very famous Psalms 137. This is after the destruction, 586 BCE. By the rivers of Babylon there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst thereof we hanged our harps. From there they took us captive. Our tormentors asked us in mirth to sing us a song of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? So this is what I call the showstopper, meaning they're telling you that after the destruction of the first temple, 586 BCE, no more music. Now, okay, end of that page. Now we're going to go into Talmud. So what we're going to do now is just see a whole bunch of pieces that are kind of the foundations for what's coming later. But I'm going to have it a little more organized after this. So we'll jump around a little bit to, you'll have to kind of go back and get ideas out of this. Okay, so the Mishnah on Arachin says, there were never less than 21 blasts in the temple, never more than 48. There are never less than 2 harps, not more than 6. There are never less than 2 flutes, flute is chalil, nor more than 12. On 12 days a year, the flute was played before the altar. So this clearly states that all kinds of instruments were used in the temple. So again, first citation for that. Now, right off the bat, when you want to say they had music in the temple, we can have music. There's kind of two related important things here. Just because they did something in the temple on Shabbat does not necessarily mean we can do it today outside of the temple. Right? They did a lot of things on Shabbat, as we all know here, like lighting fires, like wearing shatnez, like making sacrifices that we cannot do today. So you can't just pick this up and apply it there. And I was going to say the other intervening principle is that we like to say that the temple was the Beit HaMikdash, and today our synagogues are called Mikdash Me'at, little synagogues. So the idea is, on the positive side, we can copy things in the temple in our own little temples. Okay, that's the basic tension. Moving along, the Tosefta for Arachim. The flute does not supersede Shabbat. Rabbi Yossi ben Rabbi Yehuda says it does. Okay, supersede. So, what is this talking about? The previous Mishnah about playing all these different instruments is really about Yom Tov. And then we learn explicitly that the flute, the chalil, was played on Yom Tov in the temple. Now the question is the flute okay on Yom Tov, but is it okay on Shabbat? And that's what this is, does not supersede Shabbat. And we'll see this term coming up again. The Hebrew is doche, which literally means to push away. So what does that mean? Why would the flute not be okay? And the answer here is that these instruments may have been played as part of a ritual. So it's part of the service to play the flute. Just like today it's part of the service to play the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. But that doesn't mean you play it for a non-ritual reason, like for a joyous occasion. So that's why it's not clear from this piece of Talmud if that's okay or not. And it's argued. And speaking of which, we now have another famous Mishnah from Rosh Hashanah. The festival day of Rosh Hashanah, which coincided with Shabbat. They would blow the shofar in the temple, but not anywhere else. After the destruction of the temple, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ordained that they should blow in every place in which there is a court being a Beit Din. So this is a shofar example, right? You had an instrument that could only be played in the temple, not in the individual synagogues, and there were individual synagogues in those days, but after the temple was destroyed, the rabbi said you could play it outside the temple.
Well, but he's limited to where you have a Beit Din.
Yes.
So that means that if Neve had a Beit Din
then
residing,
we could blow the shofar
on Shabbat, but the synagogue down the street that didn't have the Beit Din sitting in it couldn't.
Yes, although as you will see, that also came to an end when the Beit Din came to an end. So that would not apply today.
But I thought there were Beit Dins
no,
today.
No, well, not, still... not the Sanhedrin.
Okay.
Yes. But it's a good point. Next Mishnah Sukkah. The flute was played sometimes on 5 days, sometimes on six. This was the flute of the place of water drawing, which does not override neither Shabbat nor Yom Tov. The grammar there took me a little while. First of all, what is the place of water drawing? So this is a holiday that's mentioned in the Talmud, we no longer observe, called Simcha Beit HaShoeva, the festival of water drawing, which takes place during Sukkot, where they would draw water. Obviously very important. And it was supposed to be the most joyous holiday of all time. So again, let's look at the language of override. So this is again doche, to push away. And think about this. When A overrides B, that means A is normally prohibited. Everyone get that? So, for example, we have a famous saying, Pikuach nefesh doche Shabbat. Saving a life overrides Shabbat. Meaning you can't normally override Shabbat, but when it comes to this particular thing, you can do it. So what they're saying here is, if you read it back in, playing a flute is normally prohibited on Shabbat or on Yom Tov. Okay, and now comes the $64,000 question. So why is playing a flute on Shabbat normally forbidden? Anyone want to take a guess at this?
Because
it's work.
Yeah, I was going to say it's work to play. You're blowing and...
Okay, it's a good guess.
Well, what would playing the flute have to do with building the Mishkan?
Okay, we'll get there, but it tells you that the answer is wrong. The answer of what's wrong with playing the flute is it's too loud. It interferes with the culture of quiet on Shabbat. And as we're going to see, that is the focus of almost everything that is to come. But we will return to the building the Mishkan stuff as well. So, let's talk about that.
That ties back, if I remember, to when we were discussing electricity on Shabbat. Because there were some discussions in which, even though it didn't technically violate any of the 39 categories, you didn't do it because it wasn't in the...
Your middle name is now Lawrence Straightman. I can't say things. Yes, very good, and that's exactly what the verse is. So we'll take you back to those days of yesteryear when we talked about this at length on Shabbat. I'll do this very fast. So from the Torah, we say 6 days you will do your work, but on the seventh day you will cease in order to rest. So the question was that, is resting on Shabbat a positive commandment? Ceasing to do work is a commandment. It's a negative commandment, don't work. Resting is a positive commandment. And the short answer to that was, we don't know. Sometimes, some people take it as a biblical prohibition to rest, as a biblical commandment, not a prohibition. Some people say it's a rabbinic commandment to rest, and some people say it's just kind of a custom.
Either way, I get my nap on Shabbat.
Yes. Yes, it's true. And the word here is tishbot, to rest. Tishbot gives us the word, the root shin bet tav, which is shvut. And shvut is the operative law here. It's exactly what Lawrence says. So shvut is, for our purposes, rabbinic prohibition against activities that are generally not in the spirit of the day. And the rabbis like to add, because doing them might lead you to transgress a biblical prohibition. So, example. And now this is the Mishnah in Beitzah. One is liable for all these acts on Shabbat as a matter of shvut, and they are. One may not climb a tree, one may not ride an animal, one may not swim in water, and one may not clap, slap thighs, which is Steve's particular thing, or dance. So, this is kind of the central text here. So, understand this now, and this is all comes down to how you do shvut. What are the reasons for these prohibition of the first three activities? So traditionally we say, you can't climb a tree because you might pull a branch down, and that would be reaping or pruning, which is one of the 39 forbidden activities on Shabbat. You can't ride an animal because, again, you may cut a switch from a tree and use it to hit the animal, and again, you're cutting or pruning. You can't swim in water because you may build a raft. That's what the Talmud says. And that would be building, which is prohibited. Now, it's pretty hard to fit in clap, slap thighs, or dance with violating one of those biblical malachot. So, the real answer, depending on how you rate shvut, is you don't do any of these things because they're not Shabbos-like. They're not Shabbistic. It's a good thing. You don't want to get sweated up. You don't want to do normal weekday activities. And that's the big issue. And now, if you go in that way, you can see making noises or dancing or being boisterous is kind of a not a Shabbat-like activity. Everyone good on that?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Excellent. Okay, so now we go further on that. So now we go to the Talmud Yerushalmi, which we'll see. Everything here is a Talmud Bavli except this, and we'll see later that it will show up. Rabbi Yonah and his colleagues. Oh, one other thing before I go there. So from this point on, try to keep this in mind, and I'll try to remember to point it out. The nature of the discussion is now subtly changing. So right now we've introduced the concept of shvut, which is not Shabbos-like. And we're going to see the texts go further and kind of drop ideas, add ideas, and keep an eye out for it. So here's the first one. Rabbi Yonah and his colleagues, one said, clapping this way is permitted and this way is forbidden. The other one said it is forbidden both ways. And Rabbi Yonah went on to say there were elders who were clapping their hands backwards on Shabbat. So, yes. So, okay, we'll finish reading this. Rabbi, that's Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, was marrying off his son, Rabbi Shimon, and the people were clapping backwards on Shabbat. Rabbi Meir passed by and heard the sound and said, Masters, has Shabbat been permitted? Rebbe heard his voice and said, Who is here to lord it over us in our home? In other words, Mayab, mind your own business. Rabbi Meir heard his voice and ran away. A lot of conflict going on over this issue. Rabbi Elazar said, All noisemaking is forbidden on Shabbat. So, the debate here is kind of changed now, right? It's whether the ban is on the noisemaking or on the actions that make noise, which is the hand clapping thing, right? So what's with the back of the hands? Because generally one way you get around Shabbat prohibitions is to do things in a different way. So, I don't know, I'll give a stupid example. Like, you're not supposed to write, but if you put the pen in your elbow and you do that, you're not technically writing in a normal way. So that's what the backwards hand clapping is. So when you look at the last case here, about the little story about the wedding and the noise making, does this go on? Next page, page 3. This is all still part of the Yerushalmi. Rabbi Shmuel ben Rav Yitzhak said, I love this, my grandfather used to be a knocker for the synagogue. Okay, that was a guy who went around in the morning and knocked on your door, it's time for minyan. Also thought to be like an early function of a gabbai. Rabbi Leil ben Rabbi Elin used to bang on a chair. Rabbi Elo was once learning late night, and he came to his house, and everyone was asleep. He lay down on a ladder rather than knock on a door. Rabbi Yirmiyah used to learn with Rabbi Immi's son. Rabbi Immi went to wake him up on Shabbat and began knocking on the door. He said to him, Abba, who permitted you to do that? So these last two stories are about noise, right? It's no longer about, well, it's no longer about the backwards hand clapping. So
it's about the generation of the sound itself.
So it seems like if you looked at this, you could take a lenient view and a strict view. The lenient view would be the use of the noise at all. Can you knock? Can you not knock? The strict view, I think I have this backwards, is really about, it's the other way around. That's the strict view. The lenient view is about the volume of the noise. So we're not supposed to make loud noises against Shabbat. What about if we just kind of tap at the door? And again, we'll see more of this. Okay, now we come to a piece of Talmud from Eruvin, and this, I put it in bold because in effect, this is what's going to drive almost everything after this. And it's a continuation of the same idea. Ula once happened to visit Rabbi Menashe when a man came and knocked on the door. Who, he exclaimed, is this person? May his body be desecrated, for he desecrates Shabbat. Only a musical sound, said Rabbi, has been forbidden. All right, let's stop there for a second. Okay, so Ula comes, this is the central debate. Ula comes from the strict school. Any noise on Shabbat is bad. No noise. Rava has now qualified that, and he says only musical sound. And by that we either mean music itself or even rhythmic type of noise, like drums. And this is the formulation that's going to be carried on. So let's go through the rest of this. So I'll just even summarize it. Abaye sums up a story about a sick person who had water dripping over Shabbat. And it was therapeutic for the sick person to hear that noise. So they debate again, may it not be inferred that the production of this sound is forbidden? Any sound? No, this is a case where he was awake, it was dire, he should fall asleep. So the sound heard is one like a tingling noise. He pointed out to him a further objection. If a man guards his fruit against the birds or his gourds against wild beasts, he may proceed on the Shabbat in his usual way, provided he does not clap his hand, beat his chest, or stamp his feet to drive away the animals as he normally would on a weekday. Now what is the reason? Is it not that the man produces sound and the production of sound is forbidden? So, what I'm going to propose here is that these last things are examples of what Rabbi Tucker calls white noise. It's not just loud noises on one side, and it's not musical noises on the other side, but it's kind of the everyday noises of life, walking sounds or tapping sounds or things like that. And it seems like they're saying that this white noise, like the dripping water, is acceptable. It falls in a place where sometimes you can accept that. And again now, evolution of what's going on. So, this piece of Talmud, what this sugya is saying, is it's changing the conversation, in effect, from general noise to specifically musical noise. Finally, our last piece here of, oh, and I also want to point out one other thing in that story, which is Rava, and Rava comes from Babylonia, and the other people, the Amoraim here, come from Eretz Yisrael, and you'll see that again as we go on. Okay, last story, from Beitzah. Rava bar Rav Chanin said to Abaye, we learned in a Mishnah, the rabbis decreed that one may not clap, nor strike a hand on his thigh, nor dance on a festival, on a Yom Tov. But nowadays we see that people do so, and yet we do not say anything to them. So, in other words, this is what people are doing in their shuls on Yom Tov. What do we do about it? The accepted principle is, leave the Jews alone. And this is a Talmudic principle. It is better that they sin unknowingly than that they sin knowingly.
So don't tell them that they're violating something.
Right, because it is worse in Judaism to violate knowingly than to violate unknowingly.
So he didn't attend my Monday night class. That's the problem.
That is true.
Because I mean, factually, when I went to Camp Amaro, even USY conventions, they do go up and they jump on the tables and clap. And
yes, yes. I was thinking about that very thing. I mean, I didn't go, but that is. So the question is, now here at the end of this source, how did we get to this point where people are doing stuff in shul and it's clearly against, I don't want to say the halakha at this point, but it's against what the Talmud says, you're not supposed to make noise even. So there's three thoughts at this point. One is that biblical Judaism didn't care about making music in the technical sense we've been talking about, and the strictness only came later, at the time of the Second Temple. So it used to be okay. Now it's not. Second is, specifically here, Abaye favored Ula's view, the strict view, but the people favored Rava's view. So that's how things worked out. And the third choice, which seems to be the one that Rabbi Tucker is going by generally, which I've kind of been saying, which is people were basically lax in their observance, which meant that the culture had decayed as time went by. All right, the ancestors did this, we no longer do this. That's where we are.
But did it decay, or was it more the rabbis would sit in the Sanhedrin and make the rules and not really disseminate them out?
But isn't that a kind of a decay?
No, it's a... But the rules become secretive. So here in Batsea, right, the people didn't know that they weren't supposed to be dancing and making noise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, if they didn't know, that's because they weren't taught or they weren't told. Right? Because they're not saying they're ignoring the law.
Right.
Okay. So it's possible that the laws were kind of over there, not with the people, you know, given to the people, disseminated fully.
So I think this is a very good model for our times. And, you know, I recently heard a scholar speak just this week, and he talked about people in shul using cell phones or writing.
Yeah.
And in effect, isn't that exactly the same thing, right? I mean, 100 years ago, everyone knew you can't write on Shabbat. Mm-hmm. But in our day and age, the law hasn't changed. Is it a question of it's not being disseminated? Is it a question of people are not learning it?
But
all those things.
But you also don't know that they didn't know that they weren't supposed to do it as much as they could have known they weren't supposed to do it and did it anyway. All of us are aware of the fact that you're not supposed to jaywalk. But everybody jaywalks in spite of the fact that you know that technically you're not supposed to do it. So just because, when he's saying that, you know, it's better that they be unwitting, then if you don't tell somebody, you can assume that maybe they don't know, as opposed to if you tell them, then there's no question anymore.
Right, because the unwitting thing makes me think that they didn't know, that he believes they didn't know. He's not saying you should have known better.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's not like you coming home and finding your son in the middle of a mess and saying, you know, you should have known better than to, you know.
Plus, turn on the
mixer without putting the cover on it.
You know, even tied in with what you were talking about, I think the fact that it's the people rather than a person,
yeah,
shows you can't really educate an entire crowd.
Yes, but now the cell phone thing. Okay, is a problem across all denominations. Okay, it's a big problem in the Orthodox communities as well as the conservative and reform communities. So I don't know if it's people are treating cell phones differently.
I think you could pick any one of 10 examples. What about driving to shul on Shabbat? Right. How many people are aware of what the conservative movement holds as halakha in that area? I mean, very few, I would say.
Right. This room is. This
and
room is
how many people are aware, but still do it anyway?
Right.
You know, everyone knows they shouldn't be eating non-kosher food, but many people are. So, I think it's just a general. I do think it's a laxity in the culture.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, people do what people will do, and a lot of Judaism, I think, is the rabbis kind of finding reasons to go along with what people are doing. I'll give you the famous Orthodox example, right? In the 50s or 60s, people knew you shouldn't smoke because it was cancerous.
Right.
And you have a positive Jewish commandment not to harm your own body. But they couldn't pass a halakha saying don't smoke because they would make everybody into sinners, including most of the rebbes of the day. So, but I think it's a fair point, and it's what a lot of this. So let's go on, and
okay.
And so these are basically all the arguments here. These are basically all the arguments now you've seen about music on Shabbat. And now I'm going to present the four basic arguments about music on Shabbat and the texts that go with each one. And I put them in order of, I think, strongest to weakest. So the strongest argument, I believe, is the loudness argument, the shvut argument. And again, we'll look through some texts and you'll see an evolution, I believe, in this. So first is the Magen Avot, who is a rabbi in medieval Provence in France. And he observed students of the Ramban. Now the Ramban is Nachmanides, who comes from Spain. So Nachmanides is Sephardic, the Magen Avot is Ashkenazic, and Sephardim have had a different version of halakha generally than Ashkenazim do, generally a less stringent observation. And lo and behold, the Magen Avot comes upon students of the Ramban who are playing musical instruments on Shabbat. So, you know, if you go by all the stuff we've had up there, you know, where the question is like, can you tap or whatever, here they are in their little string quartet, jamming away on Shabbat, playing harps and other instruments without any concern for prohibition. I was amazed by this. How could they have developed this practice? They claimed the only ban was on smacking and clapping, which are very loud noises, but other musical instruments were permitted.
It's the exact opposite.
Yes. So, so again, going back to the dichotomy here of Ula, no loud noises, Rava, no musical or rhythmic noises. Many authorities went with Ula. All loud noises are prohibited, because it seemed like his opinion was more strictly grounded. But now comes along this story, and it opens up a new possibility. If you're in the Ula camp of no loud noises, and I mentioned this now earlier, what about soft noises? What about musical noises? It would seem that the students of the Ramban could play because they weren't playing loudly. Now, the Magen Avot is defending a practice that goes on in medieval France, which is no music. And the newly arrived Spanish students come and they play music. So, once again, I think the conversation has changed somewhat. Okay, next example is going to be, now we can talk about the riff. So this is Rabbi Yitzhak Alfazi, who I think, he might have been one of Maimonides' teachers, but I'm not sure. So he's going to go with the Rava side. It makes sense to say that the halakha follows Rava, who said that only prohibition is on musical noise. We have seen that some of the masters hold like Ula, and they rely on the Talmud Yerushalmi. So remember I told you we studied that now, and this is why it's really interesting. But we do not hold this way. For since the sugya of the Babylonian Talmud is permissive, we don't care if the Yerushalmi forbids it, because we rely on our Talmud. So he's coming up with a slightly different answer. Next page. And its editors, and this is a classic thing, were experts in the Talmud Yerushalmi more than we are. They would not have permitted it here unless they knew that the countervailing statement from the land of Israel was unreliable. So in other words, he's saying, we follow the Babylonian Talmud, which is more lenient, and that's okay because the Babylonian Talmud, which is later, the people there already knew the Yerushalmi and already incorporated its arguments, so this is kind of the last word on things. So at this point, well, let's go to the next source here. So this is the Shulchan Aruch now, which is in the 1500s. Making noise with a musical instrument is forbidden, but knocking on a door other than similar action are permitted as long as it is not musical or rhythmic. So the Shulchan Aruch is ultimately saying that Rava wins the argument. And historically at this point, Ula, with the no noise at all, goes away. He kind of like vanishes from history.
But we still don't clap in synagogue.
Sometimes. You're saying today or then? Today. Well, okay. So we'll get there. Yes. And then Steve's slapping his thighs all the time.
In the back of my head.
Okay. So now we come to another medieval code, the Sefer Ra'aviya. I say that musical noise and that of clapping and dancing are only forbidden to Jews, but a non-Jew may play a musical instrument at a wedding. And even if the Jew instructs him to play on Shabbat, that is permitted. Right? You can't tell a non-Jew to do something for you on Shabbat that you can't do yourself. So you can't tell him, light a fire for me.
Right.
So this is a fascinating text because what it's saying is you can tell the Gentile to do it, because it's not prohibited to you. Because telling a non-Jew to something on Shabbat is only forbidden rabbinically, and it is permitted in the context of a mitzvah. All the more so here, where it is only forbidden to Jew on account of a rabbinic decree.
So, did they marry on Shabbat?
They did. I believe they did. But, so what's interesting about this? The Ra'aviya here does not endorse an outright permission to clap his hands and smack their thighs, as the Tosafot did, and I did not find that text. But his conceptual framework nevertheless follows there. He doesn't care about the noise making at all anymore. See, that argument is just gone from him. And he actually says that this is okay in the context of a mitzvah, which is kind of a new idea in here. And we'll see more on that coming.
Isn't he also saying that the rabbinic law is not applicable?
Yes. Yes. He's saying something trumps that, actually. Which we'll see. Let's look at the next one, and you'll see the answer to that.
I like this guy. I've got to read more of it.
Okay. So, Shulchan, by the way, whenever it says Shulchan Aruch, that means the law. That's the law, codified law. Doesn't mean for everybody, because there's really a Sephardic one and an Ashkenazic one. But that's the law thing. Some permit telling a non-Jew to play musical instruments at a wedding celebration on Shabbat. See, so there's your answer. They do get married on Shabbat. Note, one may even tell a non-Jew to fix a musical instrument, back to what Stu was saying much earlier, on account of the honor of the bride and the groom. But otherwise it's forbidden. Nowadays we have the practice to be lenient, following the reasoning of the Tosafot, that clapping and dancing are now permitted. I realize I'm missing this, that crucial piece of Tosafot, but I didn't find it. So at some point the Tosafot, who is Rashi's grandchildren in France, medieval France, rule that the clapping and smacking is okay. But I don't have that text.
So I can smack my thigh.
You can smack your thigh. So,
but only at a wedding.
So the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, is relying on the Ra'aviya, even though the Ra'aviya holds clapping and dancing are forbidden. But notice what he does. He actually goes further. In the previous text, it said it was okay for a mitzvah. But if you'll notice, now that's gone. He doesn't say that anymore. He says it's okay any time. We're lenient.
No, he's... for clapping and dancing, but not for musical instruments.
No, even for musical instruments.
Okay. It doesn't say musical instruments.
But it says you can tell a non-Jew to fix the instrument, so they're playing instruments.
On account of the honor of the bride and the groom, but otherwise it is forbidden.
Right, but the honor of the bride and the groom is not a mitzvah.
But it was a non-Jew that was able to play the musical instrument, not the Jew.
Right, but presumably he couldn't do that if you couldn't do that. I mean, let's suppose it's all leniency here.
But before it said that it was forbidden to Jews, but a non-Jew may play a musical instrument at a wedding.
Right.
So this isn't saying that Jews are playing musical instruments.
No, that's true.
But the difference is, I cannot instruct a non-Jew.
Typically, yes, to light a fire or to... Right, I understand that.
And I can't derive benefit...
from that either, yeah.
Okay. But here he's saying you can... for the honor of the bride and the groom, it's okay.
Correct. But for the non-Jew, not for you.
Right. So they can dance, but I can't.
Yeah. They can play an instrument, but you can't.
No, but he does say that dancing is now permitted.
Yes.
Tosafot have approved that.
The only reason the Tosafot, dancing and clapping are now permitted.
Okay, finally, the last piece of Shulchan Aruch is the Rima, who is... he is the Ashkenazi commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Moses Isserles. But there are those who clap and dance nowadays, and we should not stop them, because it is better that they do it unintentionally. So that piece of logic comes back now. And if you want, again, look at this culture of decay idea. So here, they're going full bore. It's not just clapping or something, and we don't say anything. They're dancing, they're clapping, they're singing along. And there are those who say that today all of this is permitted. All of this, because we are not, this is great logic, we are not experts in fixing instruments, and we cannot decree lest one comes to fit an instrument, for it is a thing which happens so infrequently. So it is possible because of this, the custom is to be lenient all the time on all of this. So basically this is anything goes.
Right.
And we're in the 1500s, 1500s, and the whole conversation has now shifted to, this is okay.
So, Klezmer Shabbos, here we come.
So, as a historical note here, what's very interesting is the practice of attending concerts by non-Jews on Shabbat was in fact common in Greece and Italy in the 16th and 17th centuries. Several Italian rabbis during this period not only justified, but strongly supported having non-Jews come in and play instruments in the synagogue on Shabbat. So, that's the end of argument number one about Shavuot. And as I said, what conclusion are you going to come to? Well, we'll come to that at the end. Okay, big reason number two, mourning for the destruction of the temple. We go back to Talmudic texts. They sent the following question to Mar Ukva: from where do we derive that song is forbidden in the present, following the destruction of the temple? He scored parchment and wrote to them, "Rejoice not, O Israel, to exultation like the peoples." Okay, and those of you who wish to know, song here is the word zimra. Because, after all, what does that mean? Does that include instruments? Does that include singing? Whatever. So, he's basically saying, this is the destruction of the Second Temple, no more song. And that's no more song.
Mm-hmm. That's even vocal.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, then you have another text in Sota. Now, this is back to Stu's earlier comment about the Beit Din. From the time when the Sanhedrin ceased, song was also nullified from the places of feasts. As it is stated, with song they shall not drink wine. So, here, the word for song is shir, which we know is the modern Hebrew word. Notice, it's saying only from the places of feasts. Beit HaMishtaot. So it's not, so that opens a door of, can you have it in other places for other reasons? I don't know the answer to that. but I'm just pointing it out. Now we come to the Mishneh Torah. So the Mishneh Torah is Maimonides, and he is codifying what he sees as the law from the Talmud. And I shall mention, we'll read this. Similarly, they ordained that one should not play melodies with any sort of musical instrument. It is forbidden to celebrate with such instruments or listen to them being played as an expression of mourning for the destruction, and he means the destruction of the Second Temple. So this is pretty much the red letter law that we all know in Jewish life, which is why we basically don't have music. Maimonides is tough to get around. Now, just of interest, in this piece of Mishneh Torah, he talks about, and this is important, he talks about things Jews should do to mourn the destruction of the temple, some of which I knew and some of which I'd never heard of. So, what are things we do to mourn the destruction of the temple? We break a glass at a wedding. I want to know who knows this. You're supposed to leave a piece of your house unfinished. So he says, basically, when you're washing the walls, you're painting the walls, you leave a square cubit unfinished. And I know modern-day Jews will leave a piece of their basement undone. So those I knew. Remove a cooked dish from every celebratory meal. Or set a place that no one eats at.
I do that all the time.
You do the whole time, if you leave it in the microwave.
Something.
Deliberate. No, you're supposed to remove it, though, not forget to put it.
Well, I made it. I just don't put it on the table.
From your memory?
I removed it from the refrigerator.
At her memory.
I removed it from the oven.
A woman removes a piece of jewelry from her wearing. Now, these are two I did not know. You are supposed to put ashes on your forehead at your wedding. It's for the men. And they did away with that because it looked like a Christian practice.
I was going to say, I don't remember you doing that.
And finally, you are supposed to tear your garments whenever you come to Jerusalem. So what's the point of all this? Here are the customs that we don't even know anymore. Forget the fact that we don't do them. So why are they any more less sacred than the principle of music? You can apply the same thing. We don't do those, we shouldn't do this.
Yeah. It's like the custom, tearing the clothes when you go to Jerusalem.
I would think you'd rejoice when
you I'll be tearing my clothes next week.
You're seeing the destruction.
You're acknowledging the destruction.
Because if they still held that, because the Orthodox still very much read and study the Mishneh Torah. So that would be a rule that's commonly known. And I would think that if it was something we practiced, there would be a booth somewhere with a guy with a little scissor so you can rip your garment.
It's also qualified by how long are you going there, and like, but if you go and come back and go and come back, you have to tear every day.
Well, yeah, but even so.
So
you only do it the first time you see it, whatever, there would still be some guy with a booth if they still practiced it.
Well, you always have to, always have to end the fact, it's like I was saying, Monday, this doesn't mean this is halakha.
Right.
I don't know what's halakha among this. Actually, we do know, because it's the next paragraph. Okay, so this is the halakha from the Shulchan Aruch, which we don't know if it's in practice or not. Similarly, they decree not to play music with instruments and musical devices and all things that make music to rejoice with them. There are those who say the prohibition is specifically for those who they regularly play them, like for kings who stand and rest to instruments or in the house of a feast. Okay, so there's a loophole already. It's saying it only applies to, I guess, to musicians. The tour, which is actually predates the Shulchan Aruch, it is forbidden to make them heard because of the destruction, and even song by mouth over wine is forbidden, as it says, in Psalm, I may not drink wine. And all of Israel is already accustomed to saying words of praise, or song, or thanks, remembering the goodness of the Holy One. Now, here we go. Similarly, for the sake of a mitzvah, like the house of a groom and a bride, this is permitted. So again, he's coming up with this mitzvah overrides prohibition rule, which frankly I don't quite know the source of. You may go back to this and see if it's derivable from before, but this last loophole has allowed people to really open it up, because when you say for the sake of a mitzvah, then contemporary authorities have included many, many situations that would count as the sake of a mitzvah. So, you know, it's Tuesday. Let's have a drink. So that's argument number two about the destruction of the temple. So argument number three, back to the original thing of Shabbat Malacha. So somehow the musical instruments violate the commandment of not to do work, and work is one of the 39 Malachot. And these are the five possibilities for Malacha, carrying something from one domain to another, which is why we don't blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it comes out on Shabbat. Tying or repairing, which is tying a stringed instrument, which then leads to say, what if it's not a stringed instrument? And we'll see a little more now about the organ coming in, but, you know, that's one of the arguments, is no one's repairing an organ on Shabbat, because we have no idea how to do it, we don't have the parts, we don't know what it is. Building or demolishing, like setting up a musical setup, taking it down. And finally, the final hammer blow, Makeba Patish, the final act of completion of something. Those may be rules that you forbid. For a little change of pace here, we have a source from the Damascus document and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And
what is the Damascus document?
So the Damascus document is a very famous document that they found in the Cairo Geniza, and they call it, it starts off by talking about the Damascus community, and this was in the 1800s, late 1800s, and when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, there was a copy of the Damascus document. So nobody to this day knows how it got from, it didn't necessarily go from the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Geniza in Cairo, but there was a document that someone made a copy of that they brought to Cairo with them.
Or it could have been a common scroll that was passed around.
So it's a famous thing. So in the Damascus document it says, and this is now for the Dead Sea Scroll people, who may or may not have been the Essenes, another story, they were very strict. I should even say, I don't know if I have it anywhere else here, there was a school of thought, back all the way back to making noise and loudness, that one should not speak on Shabbat, because that violated the rest of Shabbat. So they had a rule, if you should fall into water on Shabbat, you can't pull him out with a ladder or a rope or a utensil. So the Hebrew word for utensil is clay, and in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it says, if a man falls into water on the Shabbat, he shall pass to him a garment to lift him out, but he shall not carry an instrument. An instrument here doesn't mean musical instrument, it means clay again. But the point of this is, clay is means a utensil, and it is a word that is used in musical instruments. Clay shemer, I believe, is a violin in ancient times. And the whole point also of a utensil is, so utensils are mukta, which we talked about also in the electricity days, but mukta are things you're not allowed to touch on Shabbat. They're set aside, as it says. Classic example is money, because you can't spend it, so just to touch it is already prohibited. Tools are mukta. Now, over time, the rabbis again became lenient with the definition of what's mukta and what's not. But that's what all the stuff here is about, instruments. Okay, beitzah. Neither clap, nor clap his hand on the thigh, nor dance, all of these are prohibited, due to a decree that was made lest one repair a musical instrument. So basically what you get here is the Talmud. Now you can see conflating, in my humble opinion, the noise thing with the malacha thing, because they couldn't really find a justification for it, so they tried to shove it into the you'll repair it. I mean, that makes no sense why you can't clap.
Yeah.
Finally, the Tosafot in Beitzah again. The Mishnah teaches that one may not clap or dance. Rashi explained that this is because of the fear that one will fix or make a musical instrument. But for us, these activities are permitted. Oh, you know what? This is the Tosafot quote. That allows you to clap or dance. So I did have it all the time.
How about that?
When people, here's the argument, people had the skill to make the musical instruments, did this concern apply? We don't have those skills anymore, and therefore we don't need this. Now, it's kind of a little silly argument, although we do see now where the Tosafot allowed clapping and dancing. And it does allow you, and now to go back to the conservative movement in the 50s and the 60s, the organ was a very big deal in those days. And that's what their focus was.
Is that the Timothy churches?
Yes, we'll talk about that in just a minute, actually. The point of that is, I think it does make the point very well, as I said a minute ago, that this fixing an instrument with an organ or a piano is really not a good argument anymore. Okay, and if you take away this idea of having instruments that we can't fix ourselves because they're too advanced for us and we don't have the skills, that opens the door, once again, for bringing in instruments that you might not have thought of, right? I mean, a clarinet. Who knows how to fix a clarinet if it breaks? And one other thing I'll point out is the carrying argument, back to the first here. Again, with an organ or a piano, you're not going to be carrying it around. You know, I always think of that New Yorker cartoon where there's the man and his wife, and he's got a piano strapped to his back, and she says to him, "Well, Harold, I hope they'll at least ask you to play." Okay, finally, last argument. Imitating Gentiles, or Avodah Zarah, which are two different things, actually. So, Avodah Zarah is actions that lead to idol worship. And imitating Gentiles is Hukat HaGoy. We get from the chapter in Leviticus, it's very famous. After the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwelt, you shall not do. And the doings of the Canaanites, whether I bring you, you shall not do. And here it is, neither shall you walk in their statutes. So, we are prohibited to imitate the Gentiles. And that is really the basis of why, as Jews, we don't observe Halloween, for example, because it's a Gentile custom and we shouldn't do it. Although I found a very interesting entire several-page paper on why it would be okay.
Yeah, because it's no longer...
Rabbi Meisinger, growing up, was very big on that. He always said,
don't.
No, not very many people listen to him.
Yeah, see what the people are doing.
Yeah, well, yeah, because the argument is that nobody has it tied to any religious practice anymore. So,
right.
It doesn't do any harm.
And Maimonides codifies this in the Mishnah Torah. We may not follow the statutes of the idolaters or resemble them in their dress, coiffure, or their like. And he gives you three proof texts to this. So the response to this, back to the organ again, was, and the first organ was introduced into the Reformed community in 1818 in Germany, is that organs are not also traditional to Christians. It's not a Christian practice. It was something Christians picked up along the way. So that takes that away. The sages come along. So this is generally understood to be two prohibitions. The first is idolatrous customs. So in other words, if you would argue that playing organ music is the way you worship Baal, then we shouldn't have an organ. The other one is what are called foolish customs, minhag shtuyot, even if the origins aren't idolatrous. And there's again, no surprise, rabbinical dispute about both of those, which are okay. They say that the foolish secular customs are okay as long as they have a reasonable background and they're not immodest. But either of those things, if you apply it to the organ, it doesn't violate anything, this opinion. So that would make it okay. The last thing about that I talked about the organs coming in 1818. All right. There you have it. So this is Rabbi Tucker now. He says, he has a little speech at the end where he says, look, here are five possibilities for a community to think about music. Right? This really comes down to all of these follow along the arguments that have been presented tonight. And as he says, you know, we shouldn't think of halakha as a thing we want to get around. We should think of it as a thing that shapes our community and lets us be better Jews. So to that end, there are five possibilities for musical instruments on Shabbat. And here they are. So possibility number one, create as quiet a Shabbat as possible. And that's the Ula approach. And that says no noise, no banging, no knocking. It could be, you could say, very soft instruments like Ramban students. An acoustic guitar, for example, might be okay. So, historically, nobody did this. You have to add that to all of these. Number two, a community might assert musical noise has the power to affect the mood in ways that other noise does not, and such an effect is against the spirit of a relaxed, passive Shabbat. And this is the Rava approach, which says the white noise is okay. Like you can occasionally, you know, tap on the pew or clap your hands if you're so moved, but that's kind of it. Number three, a community might embrace the notion that the real issue here relates to fixing a musical instrument. So this would have the effect of no tuning an instrument, no repairing an instrument, but it might allow an organ or a piano or even an MP3 player. But this has never really been done either. It's a possibility. Number four, a community might abandon all concern for any kind of noise so that even loud musical instruments are okay on Shabbat. This is the anything goes approach. And what's interesting is the only way this really works is if some community did it, and just like the people are sinning but we don't tell them, we now say, look, there's these guys in Nutley and they do it and no one's really complaining about it, so it's possible. Okay, that would be a historical gamble, a way to change facts on the ground. Not likely to happen. And finally, the last one, the community says, we never use tools, we never generate noise or music on Shabbat, even as we've dropped those bans on clapping and so on. And in other words, status quo, what we do, what basically every conservative shul in America does, this is the way anyone who grew up in a traditional Ashkenazi shul grew up. And that's the possibility.
Do we know what the Sephardim do with this? To this?
I do not know. I don't recall hearing that any Sephardic synagogue has music.
Do they clap in?
I never saw people clapping in shul until I got to Neve Shalom.
We really don't clap.
No, we don't. Once in a while.
Sometimes people do when somebody is, when people are saying, you know, Mazel Tov or whatever, sometimes people clap.
Sometimes they clap along to